Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we'll be talking to author Heather Lendy about her new book of Bears and Ballots, An Alaskan Adventure in Small Town Politics. Welcome to the podcast, Heather.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
It's nice to have you on. I wonder if we could start by having you tell us about yourself.
Well, I live in Haines, Alaska. A very small town that's on the Inside Passage up, for those of you who are familiar with the cruise ship routes, up by between Juneau and Skagway. I'm 61 years old. I have 5 children and 11 grandchildren. My husband and I own a lumberyard and a hardware store in Haines. I wrote obituaries for the Chilkat Valley News, our local weekly paper, which I've done for the last 20 years or so. And I've written 4 books. The first one, If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name. And the second one was Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. The third one is about lessons I've learned writing obituaries. It's called Find the Good. And the most recent one is of Bears and Ballots, which is an Alaskan adventure in small town politics and chronicles my 3-year term on the Haynesboro Assembly from 2016 to 2019. What else might you want? I don't know. My life is kind of an open book, so I like to ride bikes. I have golden retrievers. I'm pretty Alaskan these days.
And so that leads to the next question, which is, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I don't know. You know, it was a very difficult time for me to be on in local politics. So I guess the real answer is what on earth was I thinking when I went into local politics and why? Haines is a very engaged small community. It's about 2,500 of us, and we're pretty isolated. We're 40 miles from the Canadian border, and you can drive to Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, through one of the largest contiguous wilderness areas in the world. So that takes a while, or you can take a ferry or a small plane from Juneau to get here. And we care a lot about our politics. And I've lived here for some 35, 36 years and very involved in the community on many levels. And I thought, well, I'm going to run for office. And it was, of course, the same year that Hillary Clinton was running. And I thought, oh, I'll join all the women who are celebrating. And we know how that went. And I honestly didn't think I was going to write about my term on the assembly because it was a very difficult time for me in many ways, rewarding, inspiring, and certainly challenging. But I'm a writer, and that's what I do. And I tell stories particularly about this place. And this seemed like a story that was worth telling and would resonate with the rest of the country and certainly people who are familiar with my books. And I'm glad I wrote it now. And I think especially going forward, maybe it'll help with what's happening to the whole country now in terms of how divided and active and engaged we are.
The book is a really personal story. It really illustrates how the personal is political. And I was wondering if you could tell us how you ended up in Alaska. You just sort of briefly say in the book you were 24 and you had a new baby and you and your husband sort of drove there. And I was like, wait, what? Like, how do you just, I think there's more to it.
there's not much. When you're just graduating from college and want to go off on life, you know, sometimes you just do these things that end up changing everything. My husband and I met in college at Middlebury College in Vermont, and we got married shortly after I graduated. And then he had studied forestry, had a master's degree in forestry, and wanted to go where the big trees were. So we bought a pickup truck and drove across the country and ended up in Alaska. And basically, we've been here ever since.
He drove until he liked the size of the trees?
Well, we came through Haines. We took, you know, you can drive, you get to Bellingham, you take a ferry up. We actually took a ferry from Prince Rupert up the Inside Passage. We ended up in Haines. By then it was September, and the town here was suffering from a kind of a big economic downturn. The sawmill had just closed, and the timber industry in Southeast Alaska was on the wane, to say the least. And so we kept going and went to Anchorage and spent about a year and a half there. I worked as a waitress. He worked in a small sawmill. And then the mill in Haines reopened and he was offered a job here. And we came down here and fell in love with the community and the environment and everything about it. And then the sawmill went broke again. And pretty much that was the end of things. And we decided to stay and take over a local regular old retail lumberyard and hardware store, much to our parents' horror and everybody's better judgment that we shouldn't do such a thing because we didn't really know anything about it. And luckily, I wasn't very involved. My husband is smarter than I am when it comes to business. And so that's kind of the story. I don't think I set out to just live here forever, but once I got to Haines, it just became my place, and it is my place and my home.
And somewhere you recruited your sister to move there too?
I didn't actually recruit her. She came up with my parents to visit when she was shortly out of college, and she fell in love with a local man here and ended up staying and getting married and living here as well. And I have a third sister who still lives back east in New York where I grew up.
We'll give her time. She'll.
I don't think so. She thinks this is really the sticks.
But you do have those stories of these connections. Your daughter's roommate was visiting and the neighbor guy fell in love with her. And
Yes, I love that story. I don't know if that's in the book or not, but I guess it might be.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's a lot of things like that that happen. That's why I love the town that I live in. I mean, I love Haines because of that. It's not really your stereotypical small town in terms of what you think of as an isolated small town where everybody's kind of related to each other and has been there forever. There's a lot of coming and going. You know, people try Alaska and they leave, or people like us when we were young show up and stay. And of course, there are multi-generational families, particularly Alaska Native families who've been here for thousands of years. But in general, there's a lot of cross-pollination that goes on. And that story, my daughter, Sarah, was attending Washington State University and was a rower there. And when she got married, one of her roommates came up, of course, for the wedding and met a local fisherman. And they fell in love and they're married now and live here and have three children. Another funny story like that is another wedding story where my daughter, JJ, at Eliza's wedding, I have four daughters and one son. At Eliza's wedding, a friend of a friend drove a van that belonged to one of the local tour companies to help get her husband's family back to the ferry from all the, you know, bed and breakfast and places where they were staying. And the driver of the van ended up falling in love with the groom's sister. And so they are now married and live in Juneau and they're expecting their first child. So there's all kinds of things like that that happen.
And while these stories might sound anecdotal to listeners who haven't read the book, they really are sort of the spine of the book, because when you're doing this work on the town council, you're aware that the people who are bringing proposals and have concerns are the neighbor, are the guy who paves the road that your grandkids live on. One person made a horrible comment when something didn't go his way that, you know, this kid hit someone's kids. It could be your grandkids. And, you know, all of these personal relationships are intricately woven in a town like this. Even though there's a great deal of autonomy and personal privacy, there's also an interrelatedness that brings you together, not just for politics, but for the stuff of your lives.
Oh, absolutely. And I found, for me, the greatest conflict of interest was friends, you know, on a national level, or I should say relationships, but, you know, it's money, it's power, it's different, lobbyists or whatever it is. In a small town, I can't tell you how many times I wished I could have declared a conflict of interest and not been able to rule on something because it was, you know, someone who is as close to me as family, but they aren't, and someone who I won't gain anything financially or personally from this decision, but it'll break my heart if I have to say they're wrong. Or, that was the, I think that I've learned anything from writing obituaries, it's that, you know, the world revolves around relationships. That's the whole thing. And that's what makes the town I live in and love so much, is all these relationships. At the same time, for me, just for my personality, I just had a terrible time trying to separate those relationships and my care for my neighbors and friends and even people that I might disagree with all the time. I appreciate their character, their way of being, and that they live in the same town I live in. So I that was the greatest struggle for me on the assembly, in the local government, was navigating those relationships and knowing that decisions that I would make could break people's hearts.
And before you ran for this office, you had been on some local boards. You'd been active with hospice and some of the other boards. And my impression from reading this is that's kind of part of being a good citizen of the town. At some point, people will serve on this committee or that board. And you said one of the ways people can be sure to get those jobs is to complain about something. And then people will say, well, great, you have all these ideas, so next year you're in charge. And they mean it very seriously. But there was still a leap for you to go from those committees and those activities to running for office.
Yes, I've served for years on the library board, as you say, hospice. I volunteer at the local radio station. And this is a town where, you know, everybody does. I mean, my husband is on assorted different committees or boards as well. My children are that live here. It's part of making a community function, is the volunteer efforts. The difference, I think, is that it's really easy to go before the assembly and advocate for library funding or to keep the swimming pool open or for more, you know, flowers in the park. But when you're actually sitting on the assembly, everything is weighed by the costs and the benefits and other issues. You have to always be looking at the big picture. And when that happens, sometimes you have to say no to other things. Also, it's just the whole structure is very formal. And when you're used to sitting in committee meetings where you're calling everybody by their first name and, you know, you're all sort of friends and generally will sit around and talk until you have consensus, being in a very formal situation where it's Madam Mayor and Assemblywoman Lindy and Robert's Rules of Order, and you're 2 minutes or 3 minutes to speak, and then you're cut off and vote, and then you're done. And a lot of the votes would sometimes be a tie and, you know, broken by the mayor. So there's half of you are very upset with the outcome and half are really pleased. It, it didn't have that same feeling as when one group is all working towards a common goal.
And that really came across, that decisions that have winners and losers ultimately have sort of a losing feeling, because if it's not everybody coming together or an acceptance of the outcome, it weighed on you at least very heavily as a loss then.
Yeah, and I think it is happening, you know, everywhere. We're seeing that when you learn how to work the system so that your side can win, even though you know that just about half of the other side is really opposed to it, but you make no effort to have any kind of concession or even understanding of what their concerns are, that just creates for kind of like bigger hammer politics. And I don't think that's healthy for anybody. I'm not a real expert on politics, but I can say in the local level, when we start to get into the all or nothing phase of things, it doesn't end well. You know, decisions that are made 3-3 with somebody breaking the tie, whether it's in something I agree with or something I disagree with, that's going to haunt you. That will come back the next election and the next election. And just like you're seeing right now, it'll be like, well, now it's our turn. You took something from us last time. Now we're going to take something from you this time, instead of we're all in this together. I think, though, in small towns, we have so many decisions that we have to make where we still understand that we are all in this together. I mean, the streets have to get plowed, and you know, the sewer has to be treated and functioning. The fire department has to come. They need a truck that works. So those kind of things still unite people who may not necessarily speak to each other at a coffee shop.
I wonder if you could take us back to when you're deciding that you're going to run, and your campaign budget and your signs and your manager. I wonder if you could paint that picture for the listeners of what it was actually like when you are mounting your campaign. What is involved?
Oh, I was so excited. And I tried to capture that. And look, I was just so happy. It was like, oh, this is a great thing. I'm going to be one of those grandmothers that, you know, is just so cool. And my granddaughters are going to think I'm just terrific. And I'm going to run for office on a, you know, community first. We're going to do the things that everybody likes in the community and be nice to each other. And it's just going to be terrific. And my friend Teresa, who's one of my oldest and dearest friends, said, oh, I'll be your campaign manager, Heather. And then she said, you know, what do we need to do? I said, we don't need signs, do we? I mean, they're just sort of litter. Oh, no, you got to have signs just so that you can show people that you're serious. You can't just assume you're going to get elected, you know, because people like you. That would be arrogant. So she got me going on trying to get the campaign going. But in the meantime, we spent about a week out at her cabin in a very isolated little village, not too far from Haines, that you can only get in and out of once a week with the ferry schedule. And they have a public bath that's nude. The town has a hot springs, and you go in, and that's where everybody bathes, men, women, children, and there's different hours for different groups of people. And there's not that many people there, like a couple hundred live there. So we did a lot of strategizing in the baths, and in terms of raising money, you know, the whole thing cost about $1,000 between newspaper ads mainly and the signs.
And you work for the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As I said, I write obituaries, which is not really working for the newspaper. I see it as working for the community. I get paid, I think it's about $75 an obituary. It may have gone up with the new editor to 100, but I'm not sure, because they're not that frequent and the checks are just deposited. But I write the obituaries for the community, and some years there might be up to 20, sometimes 15. I don't do all of them. Sometimes a staff member does, or sometimes the family does. That's unusual, but so I'm affiliated with the paper, I guess you could say, but it's not enough to even declare income on in terms of campaign finance rules. But there was a connection, obviously. And I'm a journalist. I've also worked with, I guess I shouldn't say I'm a journalist. I'm a commentator and a columnist. I wrote a column for years for the Anchorage Daily News and then the Alaska Dispatch News and for Women's Day magazine. So, but it's all family and life, you know. It's not, I don't think of myself as a political at all. Anyway, I was tied in though to the newspaper, and that ended and began a bunch of the conflicts that arose on my tenure on the assembly, especially since the other person who was new on the assembly was the former editor and publisher of the Chilkat Valley News, Tom Morford, who's a friend of mine. And Tom and I were the two new people added to the assembly during that election in 2016.
And would you like to tell us more about Tom? He's quite plain spoken, is my understanding from reading the book, that he doesn't hold back on his opinions. And can you tell us about this controversy that happened for you?
Well, Tom is an old school journalist, trained in journalism school at Marquette, went through, worked for several papers before landing in Haynes and ending up as a reporter and editor and eventually the publisher and owner of the Chilkat Valley News, which he sold as he had promised to do when he was elected to the assembly. Tom, you know, believes that adage that the role of journalism is to, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. And he brought that same value system to the assembly. You know, he had no time for people that he felt were taking advantage. He often liked to be the spokesperson for the little guy, but also he is very blunt and made for great quotes, but sometimes people would get a little bit angry with him. The controversy came when Tom and I were both targeted in a recall campaign, mainly because I think there's all different reasons. I mean, it was definitely a way to change the makeup of the assembly. And there was a third assembly member who was an artist, Tresham Gregg, who also was targeted. But the reason given for Tom and I were that we exerted undue influence on the chief of police because he had decided to remove the police blotter from the newspaper, which is a little section of the paper that catalogs all the police calls each week. You know, there was a bear in somebody's trash on Union Street on, you know, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, there was a bear in somebody's trash on up on Matthias. There was 4 bear calls on Young Road, and someone got a speeding ticket on the highway or whatever. And the chief didn't like that in the paper because he thought it kind of diminished maybe some of the work that they did. And police blotters in small towns, of course, there's a lot of sometimes funny stuff in them. But we both urged him to keep it in the paper, and he said that was coercion. And even though Tom gave the police department the space in the paper, which is at a premium when you only have 8 pages, but that sort of began the downhill slide, I think.
And is this a once-a-week newspaper?
Yes, yeah. It's typically 8 pages, sometimes 12, sometimes 16. It's not printed 2 weeks of the year over the winter holidays. But other than that, so it's 50, I think there's 50 editions a year, and it's, it's our newspaper, and it's locally owned and independent, and it's been published for over 50 years.
I used to live on an island, and the newspaper came out on Thursdays, and we didn't have a police blotter, but we did have the crime report, and it was like the most read column of the whole paper. So
it's the same idea as the crime report. It's just, instead of the crimes being prosecuted, it's the calls to the police department.
And it's really striking in the book, the difference between when the election happened and when the recall happened. Early on in the book, you take us through the election and you go to cast your vote because you get to vote in this election too. And you're being very mindful of the rules that you can say hello, but you can't say anything like wish me luck or anything that could be construed in the wrong way. You're being so careful, and no one can have a election sign within a certain number of feet. And given the geography of the town, well-meaning people have to take their signs down even though they don't think they fall within that perimeter. And so there's all this decorum, and you're casting your vote, and you kind of take us through your mindset that you're curious in a way about how people are voting just out of natural human curiosity, but not in a personal way of that you're going to take it personally however anyone votes, that you're very civic minded about this matter. And then it turns out that you are elected. But when the recall happens, they publish the names of who signed the petition. And that section, which comes later in the book, it's so painful for you as you're finding out the names of these people. And you're saying that, you said, this time the people who voted against me had a name. And that quote of the book really just leapt out at me, because in the original part where everybody was going to vote, that was the civic part of the political aspect. And when it was the recall and people had to deliberately sign the petition, it became the personal part.
Yes. And I think especially because the recall itself was presented, the recall petition itself was presented to many of those people as, it's just so we can vote again. But actually, by law, what they were signing to was that I had committed misconduct in office and hadn't told the truth. And that cut fairly deeply because I didn't think that was true. And I think that the recall organizers misrepresented that as an idea that, well, it's just so we can vote again. But I also think, it was interesting in looking back on it. And I don't mean to be such a wimp. Sometimes I think I am, but I also think that, the reason I wrote about a lot of this is that when you're vulnerable, that's where relationships happen. And that's where we meet each other, human to human, heart to heart, soul to soul. And so I felt it was important to write about how I felt about that honestly. And I know, intellectually that, you run for assembly, you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen, all those sort of comments. But when you actually see names of your friends, neighbors, associates that have signed something and who aren't voting for you, it was devastating to me. At the same time, the results of the recall election were actually better than the results of the first election. It was a solid 60-40 majority for all three of us, which by any political standard is great. That's a big win. But and at the time when that happens, when you just see those statistics, you don't think of, well, who's the other, who's the 40%? But in the case of seeing the names, I did. And again, that may have some kind of resonance with what's happening now when we wonder, what will happen with this election if it's 60-40, and we say, well, who are the names of those other people? They're not, by and large, people that we don't like. They may be, or if we knew the names, they might be people that are very close to us that would surprise us. And I don't know what that means, but I think maybe it means that we need to do better at reaching out to each other before we get to that point.
I want to circle back to a word you used when you began answering this question, which was, you said you didn't mean to be a wimp. I don't think anybody could read this book and ever have that thought come into their mind. The honesty and the vulnerability that you have here takes bravery. I think for me, if we're going to use the word wimpy, it would be to pretend that that didn't matter, that these people that you knew who had questioned your integrity and your honesty, that didn't faze you, because that would be sort of, it would be greatly out of character for you. For the, you open the book. So for listeners who haven't gotten a copy of the book yet, I will tell you, when you open the book, it's around like page 4. There is a map of the town with complete directions to Heather's house. I was a bit flabbergasted by that. And I mean, even if you make a wrong turn, you can figure out like 3 or 4 different ways to get there. You know, you just, if you blow past the market, don't worry. You can keep going down to Beach Road, make a right. As long as you get, you know, Mud Bay Road, go up Cemetery Hill and there she is. And I'm thinking, this is the most open, brave thing I've ever seen. And I have a, I mentioned that I used to live on an island and I have a friend who's a novelist there and she's a quite well-known novelist. And I mean, her mailing address is her house. And I remember saying to Nancy, doesn't that worry you? And she's like, no, why would it? And I thought, well, I think that Heather and Nancy are like kindred spirits. Like, why would that bother her to give a map to her house? But it does really open with this sense of community that you're bringing all of us into this community where everything is interconnected.
Yeah, and I guess it never occurred to me. I mean, anybody could find out once they got to Haines where I am very easily. It happens when people take a cruise ship or whatever, and then they'll say, "Oh, I'm coming to Haines. How do I reach you?" I said, "Oh, just when you get there, just ask someone on the dock. I'm easy to find." And they'll say, "What?" And it's like, our lumberyard is across the street. Just walk in and say hello to my husband and ask him where I am, or you know the. Henry, who's standing on the dock, who works for the harbor, would be able to tell you how to find me. Or the odds are one of my grandkids might be going by on a bicycle. So it's not like I could be. It would be odder if I had a big barricade around my house and pretended I didn't live where I do. Where are you going with this question? Oh, the wimpy part. What I meant was, you know, now like watching politics, I'm so impressed by the women that are just so gutsy and brave and just, you know, move right forward. And I admire that greatly. And I it's probably why I'm not running for office again, why I didn't do it again, because it's not really how I'm built. But I do admire people who can work in politics for years and years and just keep striving despite setback after setback that I'm sure have to be as personally painful and probably much more than the smaller stings and arrows that I got on a local level here in Haines. You know, the people who've worked tirelessly for, you know, social justice and women's issues and you know, for the poor and mentally ill, you know, over and over and over again. They just get rejected and they just stay in it, you know, and that to me is why I sort of said I was a wimp, because compared to the bigger picture, my angst is relatively minor.
One of the things that you kind of credit to your disposition and your take on the world is your upbringing. You said your parents were Episcopalian. You were educated in Quaker schools. Your mom was the Spanish teacher and the school principal. Can you talk a bit about being so immersed in those Quaker principles when you were a child? Because they seem to, there's a definite spiritual underpinning to your worldviews, at least my understanding of the book is that's how you come across.
Yeah, I mean, being an Episcopalian and then having that Quaker infusion, it means I don't talk about that as much, but certainly my moral compass comes from my childhood and my continued faith tradition. I still attend church every Sunday and I'm active in our local Episcopal church here. And I think, you know, the Quakers taught me that what Quakers believe is that there is, you know, that of God in every man. There's divine in each person. And of course, the Episcopal baptismal vows are, you know, respect the dignity of every human being. And then there's that overriding sense of, you know, that we need to take care of the poor and those with less and you know, love our neighbors. And so, you know, those are things that are very fundamental to my way of being. Not that I'm not a saint or anything, and I don't always do the right thing, but I try. And I'm well aware of kind of a higher authority than myself and a way of being in the world. And I'm not interested in using either I suppose my writing or my voice to add to hate or anger or pain. I want to help. And I think that is sometimes challenging when you're in politics.
I think you showed us a number of those challenges when people were coming right into your house to talk with you about things and you're still in your pajamas and you tried to set a boundary to one gentleman and say, you know, I have to call first. So he called you and said he was on his way. And you're like, you're trying to talk to the deadline. You're like, no, that's not what I meant. But also when people have very different traditions than yours, you're very mindful of that in the book. And it was one thing that I really appreciated that was there, that you were trying to grapple with things like, what is this land really supposed to be named? And who does it really belong to? And you talk about how the town is actually named. And that's a really interesting story, that it's named for someone who never actually was there. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, and these are issues that have, I really just touched on it because I wrote the book before, obviously, the big social awakening, I guess I'd like to call it, of, you know, Black Lives Matter, that also reflects back on Alaska Natives, particularly here in our part of the world. And the idea that it's always bothered me that names, the names of the places here, they had names, and they still do have names that were given to them by the first people who lived here and who continued to live here. And what happened in Haines, for instance, the town was, the town site was named Deshu by the Tlingit people. Depending on the translation, it's roughly, you know, the beginning of the trail or the end of the trail. And the town ended up being named Haines after Mrs. F.E. Haines, who was the secretary of the Presbyterian Home Missions Board. She wrote the check for the mission that became our town. And that's always just bugged me. But then there's also other names, you know, that are here, like that we still do use, but that they have a meaning that is both, I don't know, sometimes it's like metaphorical, but it's also real. Like Yendestucky is the area out at 4 Mile along the river, and where the inlet, the tide comes in, and it's called, where, you know, the translation is the place where things from afar drift ashore, and it's where all the driftwood piles up. So I used to think that it was named after sticks, that it was some sort of version of Yendestickies, but it's actually not. It's everything that from afar drifts ashore there, and in many ways, lots of things from afar have drifted ashore here. So the native names mean something. And in many communities now in Alaska, they're going back to those traditional names. And in fact, most communities, Haines hasn't evolved this far yet, but in Anchorage or Juneau or other places still, there's always an acknowledgement of being on traditional lands and an appreciation of the fact that the land is owned by the Jilkat Kwan or wherever it is in your area. And that's something that I'm going to work harder for now that I'm not on the assembly. As soon as we have a new assembly, I'm actually going to lobby to see if we can get the name of the town changed back to Deshu, which ought to be a fun way to get back into politics.
You mentioned that it's easy to find your house, and even if you hadn't put a map in your book, everybody could find you anyway. And you also talk in the book about how you host people at your house, and you contrast that to the big house in Long Island where you grew up, that it had plenty of space, but it wasn't quite that sort of environment. But this town that you're in now, it's just accepted that you'll have people in your home, both in good times and in difficult times. And one of the people that you hosted was a writer. And I believe her name is Ernestine Haynes.
Hayes,
thank you. Can you tell us about having her stay with you and what her story was?
Oh, Ernestine is one of my very favorite people. She's the current Alaska Writer Laureate. She's a grandmother. She's in her 70s. She's a Tlingit woman. For those of you that haven't read her books and you want to understand the a lot more about the Tlingit tradition and Southeast Alaska, Blonde Indian is a tremendous book. And her second book, The Tao of Raven, is also, I really recommend it. But anyway, Ernestine grew up in the old native village in Juneau, and was actually placed in, there used to be a children's home or orphanage in Haynes called Haynes House, run by the Presbyterians. She was actually sent here as a teenager because her mother was institutionalized with tuberculosis and father was gone, and she ran away and ended up running away to California and wound up homeless. And I believe she was 50 and homeless and in a car when she decided to make her way back north. And she did. She ended up in Ketchikan and then in Juneau. And by the time she was 70, she had finished high school, college, and was a professor of English. She's a remarkable person, and it's a remarkable story. And I'm really honored to consider her a friend of mine. But she stayed with us when she was here giving a talk at the library for I believe it was Blonde Indian was the Alaska Reads book that we were all reading. And so Ernestine was here, and we got a chance to talk about a lot of stuff. And I like having a friend that I can talk with about, you know, race and privilege and the way the world is. And Ernestine is that kind of a person for me.
In the book, we get a chance to meet some of the people in your town in quite a bit of detail. And then others, which is the nature of a book, they make a quick appearance, but there's the sense for the reader that there's a lot more there. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about Evelina?
Yeah, Evelina is one of the reasons I ran for the assembly. I think of her as elderly, but she's not that much older than I am, but she's wise. It's not like she looks like a little old lady or anything. She's quite fit. She walks everywhere. She doesn't have a car. And she has a dog and a wagon, and she lives within walking distance to our municipal building, and came to most of the assembly meetings and still does. She walks over and she leaves her dog on the porch and comes in, and she's very thoughtful, and she's fearless, but kind. And she frequently speaks at assembly meetings. And I don't really know her past. I don't know much about where she came from or how she got here, but she spoke quite eloquently when we were discussing a harbor project that includes a very large parking lot for big trucks. And she asked why it didn't include a nice place for her to be able to walk her dog like she does now along the waterfront, and how come, you know, municipal projects are only for people who own big trucks and big boats. But she says it like that, like she doesn't, like, why is that? Not railing at, you know, the system, but gee, aren't I as worthy as those guys? And I just felt that her voice wasn't heard enough. And I always tried to amplify it when I was on the assembly. The other thing she did, which I just love, at one of our meetings that we're about ready to, you know, we're in these assembly chambers and it's like packed. There's like 50 people in there and they're all mad about something. And I forget what it is, but we're about to have a public hearing. But before that starts, there's the initial public comment that people can comment on anything that isn't on the agenda. And it's timed and there's a microphone. And even though it's a small town and we all know each other, you have to stand up and introduce yourself. You know, I'm Evelina Vignola, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, Evelina got up and she asked if she could please use her 3 minutes to have a moment of silence. This goes back to my Quaker childhood, a moment of silence where we all think positive thoughts about one another. And to my astonishment, the mayor said, okay. And we sat there in silence, all these people who were about ready to jump at each other's throats over something that I don't even remember anymore, which is telling that I remember the silence and the positivity that came from Evelina. And we just sat there while the clock ticked. And I thought good thoughts. I don't know if everybody else did, but I just thought, you know, good for her. That was probably the best and most memorable public comment that happened in the entire time I was on the assembly.
Be interesting if that was instituted in all assemblies, just even on a trial basis. After a year, they could study it and see if it helped create more civil discourse. But that really struck me as well. And you also had notes you wrote to yourself about considering being quiet and about the power of a well-placed silence.
Yeah, I would, on the top of my agenda, every time I'd give myself notes, and there was, I wrote, be kind, be brave, be thankful. That was one that I, as a friend, one of my dear friends, Becky Nash, gave that advice to my son when he went off to Australia for a while, and he's her godson, and she's close friend, and of course their stories are all intertwined with ours in all four of my books now. Her family and our family are closely linked. I also would write, you know, gratitude. I would write, listen, don't talk, smile, be like Ray. There was a former newspaper editor and assembly person that I admired, and I'd write that down. Meet hostility with courtesy. These are just things that I would just put them on the top of my paper, and then I would look down at them, and when in doubt, they'd help me.
And for listeners, it's surprising, I guess, to realize that when you got the meeting notes, you said they could be 50 to 150 pages long. You get these packets to prepare. And on page 111, you said, I sometimes read my packet in the bathtub while drinking a beer. And I thought that was a good mindset to put yourself into, to take on something that was going to be stressful and challenging. But these were really dense packets of issues to wade through. And the decisions that you all made in these meetings truly affected everyone in town, even though this is a borough. You say it's about the size of Rhode Island, is that right?
Yes. And
the overall land size?
Uh-huh. The land size is about the size of Rhode Island. The main population lives within about a 5-mile radius of kind of downtown. But then there's outlying areas, communities, you know, little areas. They're not really towns or anything, but there's, you know, 20 or 30 people that might live out at Mosquito Lake or Lutac or, you know, along the highway corridor once it got some electrification. So there's a sort of a rural area and an urban area. Most of it is unpopulated wilderness. But, you know, there's transportation issues, there's taxation issues, there's land use issues of all kinds from, you know, mining and timber and what's going on, fisheries. But the packets, yeah, the assembly packets, sometimes they could run up to 200 pages even. And you'd get them on a Thursday at 5 o'clock, they'd be published. You'd run to the assembly chambers just before or download it on your iPad. And then the meetings were Tuesdays. So you had just 3 or 4 days to go through it all. And each item on the agenda would also have all the supplemental documents that you might want. And so it took a lot of work. And I used to just take mine. I liked it printed, so that I could read it in the bathtub. And then I'd go over it again, type more notes, read my iPad. It's a lot of work. A lot of work goes into serving in local office, and it's done by volunteers primarily. I mean, I think we had a stipend of $100 a meeting or something, maybe 150 for 2 meetings a month, even though we had about 20 meetings a month. And the decisions that are made at the local level are the ones that tend to affect people's lives directly more so than a lot of the hot button state and national issues, you know, taxation or streetlights or the library hours or some zoning issues become super local. And then, of course, there's all the employees. So there's the issues of compensation and insurance and how you pay people. And so there's a lot.
Could you briefly, because it sounds like from reading this one particular chapter I'm referencing that it was quite a lot. Could you briefly tell us about the meeting that lasted for 3 days?
the longest meeting in our history was over and this sounds kind of in the weeds, but it's a conditional use permit for driving gravel and rock trucks from a pit on the hillside through a residential neighborhood down Main Street and to the harbor. It's about a 2 mile, maybe 2.5 mile stretch across town. And the Planning Commission gave a permit to a developer to do that without any conditions on it. And the neighbors, conditions meaning, you know, the hours of the day the trucks could operate, the size of the trucks, the speed that they're traveling, the roads that they could use, all of that. They didn't put any conditions, and the neighborhood got upset, and the assembly heard the appeal, and it was epic. And there were some very hot tempers on all sides. Initially, people divided right down the line to those who support industrial development and those that don't, which wasn't really what it was about. It was just seeing how we could get those trucks through that neighborhood with the least impact and the safest way. And it was a big test for me because the owner of the trucking company is a dear friend and the godfather of one of my children. And I had another one of my daughters who lived on the road that was going to be impacted with her children, and who was opposed to any traffic going through there. And then I also had my book club members live up there. Campaign manager, Teresa, so there was a lot to do, and we really hammered it out and in the end crafted a compromise, but it took hours and hours and hours of public testimony, of adjustments. And in the end, the assembly voted unanimously for the conditions. And to me, it felt like a big success. And I called that chapter Glorious Chaos because it was like, wow, this is how you govern. And as you alluded to earlier, the really tough part was when we were all done, I turned to one of the neighbors on the street and I said, well, you know, I think we did okay. You know, we were all sort of euphoric, like you get after running a marathon or something. Just so tired. And he said, no, I'm not happy. And you should be ashamed of yourself because one of those, you know, trucks could kill one of your grandchildren or something to that effect. And I was just, it just sort of was such a punch to the gut. I didn't even know what to say. I just had to leave immediately because of course I adore the driver of the trucks and I adore my grandchildren. I thought, really? Is that what you say to somebody who's just put in like days of work to do something for the common good? And that's what it's going to be about. That's what you're going to tell me. I mean, I don't know. Even if you think that, you might not want to voice those kind of thoughts out loud, especially right to somebody's face.
Yeah. Wow. It was powerful in the book, and it's powerful hearing you talk about it as well, especially because in earlier chapters, you made sure we got to know your granddaughters a little bit. So mm-hmm. they weren't just an abstract idea of what if these were your grandchildren? It was, you actually had us meet your grandchildren. I wonder if you could tell us about the Christmas tea party that you had for your grandchildren, because I just love that scene.
Well, I try every year to, you know, do a little something. I'm not like great at doing all these holiday things, but I try. And right in the middle of, we had a big old mess. The manager was fired. We were trying to hire a new one. Of course, December in Alaska is dark, dark, dark. We're talking, you know, 5 hours of daylight a day. And it was sort of that mix of rain and snow that really is not Hallmark Christmas weather. It's just pretty horrendous. I had the grandchildren over right in the middle of all this turmoil, and I wanted to have a perfect little Christmas tea. And I want them to know, you know, where they came from. And some of that probably has to do with the fact that I live in a place where the people who are here first know very much where they come from, and they're still here, you know, the native Alaskans. And I realize the value of that, for my grandchildren. So I have my mother's china and I get that all out. And I listen to the Messiah every year at Christmas, even though that's not really necessarily a big Haynes thing. Although our choir, actually, we sang a sing-along, a community choir Messiah last Christmas, which I hope we can do again someday. And I had them all over and I tried to, you know, show them how to have their tea and their little sweets and then listen to the Messiah. And then things just went south really quickly, as they always do in my stories. And pretty soon, you know, it was like Jingle Bell Rock. And then there was the playroom in our house is upstairs. It was one of the kids' bedrooms. And so I had four little granddaughters here between the ages of 3 and 7. And pretty much chaos ensued and things crashed and people fell asleep and Sylvia Rose took off her clothes. And that's what we always call her, Sylvia Rose, who wears no clothes. And she was crying and on the dog bed. And, you know, anyway, it was just one of those happy Christmas moments.
It was so authentic. I mean, we all have those family stories of, you know, you remember how it started all great and then someone broke something or someone got stitches. You know, it's just so the human condition that we have these glorious moments that are perfect, but they are the moments and the rest of it is, you know, the stuff. And that's really what the whole book is about. It's about the importance of community and the importance of relationships and the work to create a more just world, and how most people have a very different take on how you can do any one of those, let alone all three.
I think what we all have in common, though, is that we all want that. I think we crave it almost. And I think if anything, this the pandemic and the isolation has made that abundantly clear, that we need each other. And we need each other in the good and the bad and the disagreements and the agreements. And we don't just need people that are like us. We need everybody on one level or another. And, you know, even thinking about that story now, I'm like, oh, I'm getting a little teary because I don't know when I'll be able to have a whole house full of children again. That's not happening this winter. And I miss that so very much. And I even miss going into the assembly chambers with all those grumps with their arms folded glaring at me, because, you know, going to an assembly meeting on Zoom just isn't the same. There's something missing, and that something is people, the human connection.
And one of the takeaways I took from the book was, you talk about the danger of being in an us versus them mentality. And you suggest that the solution is that instead of being against something, it's really important to be for something. What is it that you are for?
Oh, well, I mean, I think I'm for, you know, on the political level, you know, I'm for public libraries, I'm for public schools, I'm for safe neighborhoods, I'm for everybody having enough to eat and having good health care, you know, being treated with respect and dignity, all those things. But mostly, you know, I'm for kindness and respect and the common good, you know, for raising up the bottom and how that brings us all to a better place. You know, I guess I'm just tired of the bad guys and the fat cats getting everything. And I think, I don't think that's an unusual thing. So yeah, you know, I'm for the fish and I'm for clean air and clean water and children learning in safe schools and everybody getting a fair shake. And I honestly, I can't imagine that other people aren't for those things.
What do you hope this book sparks?
I don't know. I guess a connection to people in their local government so they pay attention and realize that the issues that are happening at the local level are the ones that are really worth spending some time on and that really will change the world. You know, that you can live in your own small place or your own small way you can make a difference, and you're probably going to make a bigger difference than you do with all the tweeting and clicks and everything else that's involved with, you know, more topical things that are in the news, that the stuff that isn't in the national news might end up being more important. So it's worth doing. I think also the importance of kindness, holding your tongue, not being the, you know, the mean little comment. You know, if you don't want your grandchildren to hear it or see it, why would you say that stuff on social media any more than you would in a room if they were sitting in the front row? And I hope people will think about that. And also, you know, the ways that we speak to our public officials. I mean, I don't care what side you're on. No one's going to listen to you if you call them names and tell them what an idiot they are before you put your comments in. It's just human nature. And so it really helps if, like you say, you think about what you're for and you remind your senator, your congressman, or your mayor, or your local assembly person that this is what I'm for, and thank them for helping you make that happen.
I wish we could have another hour to talk about this book because there's so much more in it. There's issues about global warming, and you say you can watch the, you know, the changes of the glacier happening just in the time since you've been there. And there's just so much more that when listeners get their copies of the book, that they will find. In the few minutes we have left, would you like to tell us what you are working on now, whether it's more bicycling or ideas for another book, or what's up for Heather now?
Oh, well, right now, actually, one of my books, Find the Good, is the Alaska Reads book for this year. So I have, in the most immediate October, November, I have all these Zoom calls to libraries all over the state of Alaska. And that, I'm really looking forward to that, you know, talking to kids in the village of Aniak, you know, four or five of them on a Zoom about Finding the Good, which is a challenge at any time. But right now, I think really important, not because that there aren't bad things in the world, but precisely because there are. Like, we really need to focus at least a little bit of our energy a day on something positive. My focus at this moment tends to be on my family. My dad is elderly, 87, and he's just arrived here for the winter. And my sister and I are figuring that out. And I have a couple of grandchildren that are being homeschooled that I'm trying to help their parents with during the pandemic. So I'm sure stories will come out of it because that's what I do. But for the moment, I'm in this kind of the same sort of COVID craziness that everybody else is, and just hoping to get through the winter.
Well, those all sound like really important projects, both the Alaska Reads and your dad and the homeschooling help. They all sound important. And I look forward to having you back to talk about the next book. Thank you so much for being on the show today and telling us about your book of Bears and Ballots, An Alaskan Adventure in Small Town Politics. We've been talking with Heather Lendy. I'm Christina Gessler. You're listening to New Books Network. Please join us again.